Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another Peak Prosperity podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. Well, here it is. It's July of 2012, and the world faces the prospects of an extremely poor harvest due to droughts in the U.S., other weather disturbances across the globe. Global coal consumption continues to increase with every passing day as two new coal-fired electricity plants are brought online each week, and as the limitations and expense of solar, wind, and conventional nuclear technologies are illuminated, perhaps it's time to try something new. Now, as I've said at many points in my writing, presentations, my book, we don't really need any new technologies to be discovered. There are, in many cases, solutions already on the shelf that we simply have to get serious about adopting. Now, there is one technology up on a shelf that we could take down, dust off, perhaps give a try. First tried experimentally back in the 1960s, the idea centers on using nuclear materials in a liquid fluoride salt form instead of a solid form, and specifically using thorium in that fuel cycle. Today, we're talking with Kirk Sorensen, a leading proponent for liquid fluoride thorium reactors, LFTRs, or LIFTR technology, and co-founder of Flybe Energy, dedicated to developing a thorium-based reactor. Now, Kirk has been studying thorium technology since 2000 and operates the website energyfromthorium.com. Welcome, Kirk.
Thanks a lot, Chris. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Great. Well, I've certainly received a lot of requests to investigate thorium reactors over the past couple of years and to talk with you in particular. So before we get started on that, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, your training, your current position?
Sure. My training is in engineering. I'm an aerospace engineer, and I have a master's degree from Georgia Tech, and I'm working almost done with another master's degree in nuclear engineering from the University of Tennessee. I spent 10 years with NASA doing technology development at the Marshall Space Flight Center, then a year with Teledyne Brown Engineering here in Huntsville as their chief nuclear technologist, and then last year with my co-founder Kirk Doria started Flybe Energy to develop and commercialize LIFTR technology.
Oh, fantastic. So this LIFTR technology, let's dive right in. First of all, what are the key problems that we're trying to solve here in the energy space as you see them?
We need to drastically reduce the cost of energy generation while at the same time dramatically expanding its availability to the world. And the number of energy sources that are capable of doing that are really, really few and far between. And then when you whittle it down even further to having energy sources that are dispatchable and reliable, the list gets really short. To me, it becomes clear that we have to access the energy of the nucleus if we want to have dense, low-carbon, reliable energy. And then the question becomes, what path do you want to take? Do you want to take fission or fusion? And I think a lot of people, including myself, were initially enamored with fusion, but found reasons to realize that it's going to stay on the horizon for a long, long time. And then I, through a series of accidents, learned about a totally different form of nuclear fission power based on thorium that had, as you mentioned, had been substantially investigated in the 50s and 60s by, in my opinion, some of the most brilliant minds in the world, and rejected for reasons that I don't think stand up to scrutiny today, reasons that were largely political and not technical in nature. And so that's why for years I wondered, why aren't we doing this? But I was at NASA doing aerospace work, and it just sort of sat on the side until I started that website and began to engage a more global community in this discussion. And one thing led to another, and it became clear that I needed to be a part of making this happen. And that's why I took the move to start Flybe Energy last year.
Well, great. So let's start right at the beginning of this. And thorium, it's an element. It's right there on the periodic table. It's different from uranium, obviously. And we use uranium in maybe 450 nuclear plants worldwide at this point in time. It's a fission-based reaction. What is it about the thorium fuel cycle? First of all, how does thorium get used in the fuel cycle? Second of all, what advantages does it have over uranium?
All right, those are the best questions. the way thorium is used, uranium has two isotopes, one of which is fissile, the other of which is fertile, means it can become fuel but isn't fuel initially. Thorium only has really one naturally occurring isotope, and it's fertile. So you need some fissile material with which to start the reaction. But what happens is neutrons bombard thorium, and thorium absorbs, the thorium nucleus absorbs a neutron and turns into uranium-233, which is fissile, which is a fissile material. And that's really where the magic happens, because when uranium-233 fissions, it gives off enough neutrons to continue the conversion of new thorium into fuel and existing U-233 into energy through fission. And I know that probably sounds like a mouthful, but this is really kind of where the magic is it's the only nuclear isotope that does this in what's called a thermal spectrum reactor. That's what's different about thorium than uranium, is it gives off enough neutrons to continue its consumption. Analogy I've heard used before, it's kind of like when you go camping and there's wet wood and there's dry wood, you know, and you can start the fire with dry wood, and if you get the fire hot enough, you can even burn the wet wood. Thorium and uranium-238 are both like the wet wood. You know, if you dry them out through the form of turning them into fissile material, then you can burn them for energy. But only thorium can do this in a thermal spectrum reactor. And that begs the question, what's a thermal spectrum reactor and why should I care? It's a reactor. All of our reactors today are thermal spectrum reactors. And what that means is they slow down their neutrons. It makes them much more... they're able to get a lot more energy per unit of fissile material, and they're a lot easier to control. That's why we do it that way. Some people have talked about fast spectrum reactors. That's the way that you can potentially consume uranium more efficiently, but it's the only way you can consume uranium more efficiently. Thorium can be consumed efficiently in a thermal spectrum reactor. So at its basis, that's thorium's fundamental advantage over uranium, is the ability to be consumed completely in a thermal spectrum reactor.
So it's being consumed, and it's going through this process where ultimately it's getting converted into U-233, which is then ultimately giving us our completing the cycle and renewing it as it goes around. So in this, is that roughly right?
Yeah, I mean, one way to think of it, and this isn't rigorously accurate, but uranium-233 is almost like a nuclear catalyst for burning thorium, because as you burn the U-233, you give off enough neutrons to make new U-233 from thorium. All U-233 comes from thorium.
Right, so let's contrast this then with a conventional nuclear reactor, you know, the Fukushima one, which obviously is giving the world a lesson in the dangers of nuclear technology. So this is a solid fuel reactor. They have these solid pellets that are created out of a mixed oxide. They're clad in this zircaloy sheathing to make these rods, and in that process, how much of that nuclear fuel is actually consumed and how much becomes waste?
From the original uranium ore that you've mined out of the ground, you're only consuming about half of 1% of the energy there. And that's not happening because we're stupid. It's happening because there is a basic limitation. In a thermal spectrum reactor, you can't make more plutonium from uranium-238 than you consumed. It's just not possible because plutonium, when it fissions, does not give off enough neutrons to continue the conversion reaction. That's the basic salient difference between it and thorium. In order to get plutonium to perform better, you have to go to a fast spectrum reactor. And that's what the nuclear industry has been dreaming of for 50 years, but really hasn't happened because there are some substantial disadvantages of taking that approach. So thorium's advantage is that it can be used sustainably in a thermal spectrum reactor.
All right, so when we're burning, you know, getting maybe half of 1% of the energy out of the solid fuel reactors, the rest presumably becomes a byproduct waste that
yeah.
we have to deal with, right? We store it in pools and figure out, well, we don't actually have a plan for it at this point, as far
we
as I
don't.
Can tell.
And let me split it into two waste streams. I mean, in the enrichment process, where uranium is rich in the first place, 5 parts out of 6 of the uranium become waste, and that's where depleted uranium comes from. You know, that's uranium where you decrease the amount of uranium-235 in it. So right off the bat, there's a, you know, 85% cut. So only like 15% of the uranium even makes it into the fuel rods. And of that, only a few percent is consumed. That's a few percent of 15%. That's why it's really, really poor fuel efficiency. And thorium offers the potential for radically improved fuel efficiency.
So give us some numbers. If when we start using the thorium cycle, how much would actually get converted into energy?
if we use lifter technology, if we use the liquid-fueled approach that we're talking about, we anticipate that we could probably get above 90%. The theoretical limit is about 98.5% that you could actually consume. But it looks like getting in the high 90s is very doable.
High 90s from a half of 1%.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's almost nothing else in the world where you're talking about this level of radical improvement in technology. I mean, I used to work a lot on solar cells, and you know, to get from 10% to 30% was considered like the greatest thing in the world. I mean, we're talking about going from half a percent to high 90s.
All right, and one of the things that I'm acutely aware of is I track world uranium supplies. I know that China was building, I think, 36 plants and was scouring the globe for enough 40-year uranium contracts to be able to fuel those. And that was even a stretch. So the idea of could we possibly replace 10,000 coal-fired plants with, you know, 5,000 new nuclear plants, answer from at least a resource standpoint right now has to be no. Tell me about thorium in terms of how much is out there.
Well, thorium is about three times more common than uranium to begin with. So there's a basic advantage that you have. And because the thorium only occurs essentially in one form, in one isotope, it's all usable in the reactor. So right now, thorium is basically a waste product of rare earth mining. It's always found with rare earths. It's found in monazite sands. And in fact, when rare earth companies are looking for rare earths to mine, they'll advertise that they've got a low thorium content vein because the thorium is considered worse than worthless. It's radioactive, very low level of radioactivity, but nevertheless radioactive, and they have to take regulatory steps to dispose of it. So to say it's cheaper than free is there are rare earth companies that would pay you to take the thorium off their hands.
Okay, so are there piles of this stuff sitting around somewhere waiting to be used?
Under about 12 feet of dirt in the Nevada test site, the United States recently buried about, I think it was 3,500 tons of thorium that had been in the strategic stockpile for 50 years. You know, back in the 50s when guys like Alvin Weinberg were saying, you know, we're going to run the world on thorium in the future, the United States made a far-sighted move to stockpile thorium. And then the people that were making thorium into reality got reassigned and fired and so forth. And in the early 2000s, they said, well, what do we want to do with all this thorium? Oh, it's worthless. Let's throw it away. So that's essentially what they did. So I tell people the best thorium mine in the world is sitting under 12 feet of dirt in Nevada right now in nice barrels that would be easy to recover, already isolated and purified and so forth.
Yeah, that would be a good mine to run. That would probably have a pretty good yield off of that. Hey, so talk to me about a thorium reactor. What is it? How does it operate? And then we can talk about maybe its advantages over existing technologies.
Yeah, and I'll talk to you about the lifter, the liquid fluoride thorium reactor, and that is an example of a thorium reactor. There's a lot of different ways to do it, and not all of the other ways using thorium are nearly as efficient, and that's something I really need to point out. If you try to use thorium in an existing light water reactor, you're going to do marginally better than what we're doing, but you're not going to have these kind of radical improvements in fuel efficiency. This is really a consequence of using thorium in the liquid-fueled state. So our company is called FLIBE Energy, and it's a little bit of a wink and a nod. FLIBE is a chemical nickname for the salt that we use. It's lithium fluoride, beryllium fluoride, so LIFBEF2. You rearrange the letters and you get FLIBE. It's a great solvent for nuclear reactions because it's very stable at high temperatures, and it's completely impervious to damage from radiation because it's a salt. It doesn't get damaged. There's no crystal lattices to dislocate or anything like that. It's a marvelous material for holding a nuclear reaction in it. So what you do is you dissolve uranium and thorium as salts into the FLIBE salt, and you pump it through a reactor vessel that has graphite in it. The graphite will slow down, it's called moderating those neutrons, slowing them down to thermal energies. And that's where they have the maximum chance of causing another nuclear reaction. And so within the reactor vessel, that's where the fission is taking place. It's heating the salt. The salt passes out of the core into a heat exchanger, and it heats a coolant salt, which in turn passes outside of the reactor vessel and drives a gas turbine system. So that's, in a nutshell, how you turn the energies of thorium into electrical energy.
And in this technology then, so we're talking about liquid salt, is this, do we have issues of corrosion, or I'm going to start navigating towards, obviously, in a post-Fukushima world, the design parameters, the safety parameters of maybe this technology versus other ones?
Well, you have to, the salt is very chemically stable, so stable, in fact, that most everything else looks pretty unstable compared to it. And you have to put that in the right materials. I mean, you can't just go stick it in stainless steel. But they developed an alloy at Oak Ridge called Hastelloy N, and it's now manufactured by Haynes International in Kokomo, Indiana. I went up there a few months ago and actually saw them making the stuff. Flibe salts with thorium in them do great in Hastelloy N, and they verified this through the operation of a reactor at Oak Ridge National Lab. So as long as you choose the right materials and you operate the machine properly, corrosion is not a problem.
Okay, so we're operating this thing. There's a fuel cycle going on. At some point, obviously, certain other isotopes are going to be building up, or other actinide products. Something is building up at some point, and you're going to have to either replace or refurbish the salt in some way. What's the fuel cycle look like in this thing?
All right, well, that's a good thing about the salt. See, the salt is not damaged by radiation like solid fuel elements are. And so what you need to do is you need to continually add new uranium-233. There's actually two salts in the core. There's a core salt, fuel salt, that has the uranium-233 tetrafluoride in it. And then there's a blanket salt surrounding its flibe with thorium tetrafluoride in it. And the blanket salt is absorbing neutrons. Some of that thorium is turning into uranium-233. It's chemically extracted, and then it's introduced into the fuel salt. So the fuel salt is always being refueled from what is being generated in the blanket. And in turn, it's generating neutrons through fission that are turning blanket salt into uranium-233 fuel. Fission products do accumulate in the core salt. So periodically, what you do is you take the fuel salt and you fluorinate out the uranium. It will come off as a gas, uranium hexafluoride. And that leaves the flibe, the bare flibe salt, and the fission products. And then you go through a step called distillation, where you heat the salt to about 1600 degrees, and the lithium fluoride and the beryllium fluoride will boil out of the salt. So you're left with just the fission products. And that's really how you separate the fission products, which are the true waste, from the original flibe salt and the uranium and thorium. So you keep all the actinides in the reactor. The actinides don't end up in the waste stream, the actinides being the thorium and the uranium, and you just extract the fission products. And that would be about a ton of fission products per year. Most fission products stabilize very quickly. They're intensely radioactive when they're formed, but because they're so intensely radioactive, they're decaying very quickly. In fact, most decay in terms of a few days. Some take weeks, and a few take years, but it's really remarkable. I spent a lot of time modeling this. It's really remarkable just how fast fission products decay to stability.
In this scenario, obviously, in the conventional nuclear technology, some of those fission products have half-lives that are measured in decades and longer.
Yeah, there's two in particular, strontium-90 and cesium-137, that have 30-year half-lives, and they're most of the trouble when it comes to fission products. But there's a rule of thumb, 10 half-lives and it's gone. So in 300 years, strontium and cesium decay essentially to they decay away to stability.
Right. So when you mentioned a ton of waste per year, that obviously you could let that sort of reduce itself over time through half-life decay. But that ton per year, at what scale are we talking about?
That would be if you were running a gigawatt plant for a year.
A standard gigawatt
reactor. Pretty typical plant. Because each plant will burn through about a ton of thorium each year and produce about a ton of fission products. Most of those fission products are stabilized very quickly. For instance, xenon, it's about 15% of the fission products. It stabilizes in about a month.
Okay. So we have a ton per year. And compare that to the waste stream off of a conventional reactor?
Well, a conventional reactor also produces about a ton per year of fission products, but most of the waste in a conventional reactor is unburned actinides. About 95% of the fuel is uranium-238 that's still there, it's not consumed, and then you've got about 1% uranium-235 that wasn't consumed, about 1% plutonium and some higher actinides like the americium, curium, neptunium. That's really the stuff that drives the long-term waste management issues is the higher actinides, the sometimes called the transuranics, the stuff beyond uranium that really is the headache for long-term waste disposal. In the thorium fuel cycle, you really minimize the production of transuranics entirely because you're starting from such a lower number. You're starting from 232 instead of starting from 238. So you go through a lot of steps where fission is very likely before you make it to your first transuranic.
All right. So you mentioned that there was some experimental work done on this at Oak Ridge back in the 50s and 60s. So how close did we get to actually seeing a full demonstration of the thorium fuel cycle?
Well, the full demonstration was actually the next step. They ran an experiment called the molten salt reactor experiment from 1965 to 1969. That was mostly about understanding the operations, evaluating material compatibility, so forth. It was very successful. They shut it down. They appealed to the Atomic Energy Commission for monies for the next step, which would have been called the molten salt breeding experiment. And that would have shown the complete approach with thorium and making power from thorium and generating electricity. At that time, the Atomic Energy Commission, though, was fully committed to the plutonium fast breeder reactor, which was cooled by liquid sodium. And they didn't want any distractions from their plans, so they pretty much arrested with extreme prejudice the research into thorium and molten salt. That was really unfortunate because within just a few years after that, the plutonium program had been canceled by President Carter. And that would have been the moment in about, 1977, 1978, that somebody should have said, hey, maybe we made a mistake killing thorium back in 72. Maybe we should go turn that back on again. But as far as I can tell, that reevaluation never took place. And the knowledge of what happened at Oak Ridge really faded further and further into the collective memory. I continue to be amazed at the people I've met who, these are people who've had, long careers in the nuclear industry, and they come to me and they said, Kirk, I have never heard of this before in my life. And it wasn't until I read those documents on your site that I really believed that this really happened. In fact, just the other day, a gentleman who I've read his work before, very, very experienced and qualified, PhD in nuclear engineering for 30 years, he said, my friends have been telling me about thorium, and it was on the periodic table. Other than that, I never appreciated its advantages for making electrical power.
I guess part of the problem is that in the thorium cycle, you do end up with 233, which uranium-233, which I guess was used as a nuclear bomb core in Operation Teapot in 55.
We don't know much about Operation Teapot. We know that there was some U-233 and some plutonium in one weapon. Mm-hmm. We know that that was a test, that it was kind of a dud, it was a fizzle, it didn't work as good, and it was never followed up on. So I would not call the existence of uranium-233 a problem. I mean, that's a basic feature of the thorium fuel cycle. Uranium-233 has never been used in an operational nuclear weapon. It has always been highly enriched uranium or plutonium. And there's some real disadvantages to using uranium-233 for nuclear weapons, and I think that's why it's never been done and never will be done.
Right. That was the point I was driving at, was that Oak Ridge had a number of mandates, and making electricity wasn't its sole mandate. So sounds like the thorium fuel cycle really only has one high and best use, and that's making electricity. So perhaps it got shelved for reasons that weren't entirely related to energy.
Well, we had a huge weapons program going on that was giving everybody a lot of experience with how to enrich uranium and how to chemically separate plutonium. That was the first two things we learned how to do in the Manhattan Project were those two tasks. So it's not terribly surprising that when we turned our attention to making electrical energy, we sort of went to what we knew, which was highly enriched uranium and plutonium rather than thorium, which they looked at thorium very early on in the Manhattan Project. First question was, can you make a bomb out of it? The answer was, well, theoretically, yes. Practically, no, not really.
Not ideal. Not the best stuff around. So, okay, so we have a part of the cycle has been demonstrated. Let's talk about what it would take to get all the way through the demonstration of this at this point. How much of the technology do you believe can be dusted off? Obviously, you've mentioned one thing, that the people involved in this have aged. Some of them have probably died. So we've maybe lost some of the... We'll have to relearn a few things is kind of what I'm getting at here.
You're absolutely right, and I've been in pretty regular contact with the surviving members of the molten salt reactor program in Oak Ridge. And, these are guys that are in there. I mean, the young ones are in their late 70s. Most of them are in their 80s. And to be more honest, most of them are dead. So the biggest challenge that faces us is relearning this set of skills that they were in possession of in the 60s and 70s, about 200 of them, and trying to take the next... I mean, we still really are on the same step we were on 72, which was go build the demonstrator reactor. That's what we've got to go do.
And so what would it take to get that done? Time, money, experience?
Well, I think based on what we've got now as far as technology and codes and software and so forth, I think that task could be done for a couple of $100 million. And if we were fully funded, probably about 5 or 6 years. I mean, that would be like, let's go make this happen. This is a high priority. That would be to build the demonstrator, to go beyond the demonstrator to a system that was ready to be sold to make electrical power is probably another 5 to 10 years beyond that.
And where are we on that? And you've obviously, you started talking about this, and then there's been a big increase in interest because of your efforts around that. How close do you think we are to getting the right kind of interest to really go forward with the initial demonstration project?
Well, one thing that we're definitely doing differently than what was done before is we're pursuing this as a privately financed venture rather than government research. You know, I thought for a while that perhaps the DOE would pick this up or it would be done under government auspices, but that doesn't appear to be the case. And unfortunately, the DOE hasn't ever developed a reactor that then went into commercial use since they were created in 1977. So I strongly believe it's got to be the private sector. That said, though, it's got to be some fairly far-sighted investors. You know, this is not like developing an app for your iPhone. This is some serious money and some serious patience. But the payoff potentially is truly staggering. I mean, you would have a machine that would be able to meet the bulk of humanity's energy needs for the foreseeable future. I mean, we're not going to run out of thorium at the kind of efficiencies we're talking about. And energy itself is about a quarter of the entire planetary economy. And more than that, it's the quarter that makes the other three quarters work. So, I mean, the potential payoff for this is really, truly astronomical. It's just that there is a large barrier up front. And so we are searching for far-sighted investors, far-sighted, deep-pocketed investors, to help make this happen, to help pull the stream off.
And if we decided to get serious about this, whatever the motivation was, whether people were worried about climate change or national security or whatever the issues happen to be, if the government did get serious about this, give me a best case. Like I know there's a lot of fudging here, so we're not going to hold you to these numbers. But if we really got serious about it, Manhattan Project style, this is what our nation's really putting a significant whole percentage portion of its revenues towards. What would happen? How fast could we do this?
Well, Manhattan Project style is really interesting because I've read a lot about the Manhattan Project. I mean, Manhattan Project style is you call up people and you go, drop whatever you're doing, you're going to move to a new place, and this is what you're going to work on. I mean, if we really did that, Manhattan Project style, we could probably have a demonstrator up and running in 2 years. But, I mean, that's like everybody's working 80-hour weeks, you don't see your families, and the government essentially expropriated you out of what you were doing.
Uh-huh.
You know? But yeah, if you really want to go that level, yeah, we could probably have one going in 2 years at that kind of seriousness. Because we have the materials, we have the fuels, and we have the knowledge to go forward. But I, for one, really would not want to live under that style of project. I prefer another style I call the Skunk Works approach, and I used to work at the Skunk Works in Lockheed when I was younger. And that is, shall we say, 50-hour weeks.
Uh-huh.
And you get to live with your families, and you get paid, but it is a very serious effort behind it. You know, the government is making available important materials, because there's some materials this machine needs that you don't buy. Like uranium-233, the government has some. I mean, they're either going to let you use it or not, but you don't get to buy stuff like that. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. So Well, first of all, if people want to find out more about this, obviously they can go to your website, which is really, really well done. It's got some just great materials on there, very easy to step through for anybody in particular who's interested in the technology, more specifically, you know, what's really involved in a more technical level. There's some great stuff there. There's some really nice presentations you've got there, and that is energyfromthorium.com. But if people were listening to this and said, you know, this sounds like a great idea, I would like to help get this off the ground, what could they do?
They can get in touch with us, and we can talk further.
Okay. And do you feel like is there any benefit at this point at all? Are we even close to wanting to illuminate this and raise it to the governmental levels? Is there any interest there at all at the DOE at this stage?
We have been continually trying to do that for the last 5 years. I've made many trips to D.C., spoken to people at House, Senate, DOE, Office of Science and Technology Policy, always trying to shine the light on this. Yes, it needs to be done. You know, you get a lot of the variety of answers you might expect. You know, well, why is an industry doing this? Well, then we incorporate. Okay, we say, well, we are. Well, how come the industry we expect isn't doing this? You know, I said, well, their market model is based on solid fuel and providing solid fuel services. This is completely different. Number of people who say, well, gas is cheap and we don't have to worry about these things right now. Stuff that, you know, we've seen gas be cheap and then be expensive and then be cheap and then be expensive. And I look at it and I go, why don't we get off this hamster wheel altogether and really achieve energy independence, which I'm convinced is completely doable. I know it's very fashionable to say we cannot achieve energy independence. I go, you don't know about thorium. You'll change your mind once you learn about thorium.
Now, let me ask you this. Would you imagine that it would be the similar style of plant? So we're going to put two, three, you know, four reactors all together. We're going to have, you know, 2 to 4 gigawatts of generating capacity. It's a thermal plant at heart. So we're going to need big cooling towers, a water source, all of that. Are these similar in design to essentially having the same footprint and water requirements as a boiling water reactor?
Or? No, they're going to be very, very different because the salt operates at such high temperature, and because we're using gas turbine power conversion system rather than steam turbine, we actually could employ air cooling on these systems and reject heat directly to air, and that would get rid of the cooling towers. It would get rid of the need to be sited next to a body of water. I mean, all these things become thermodynamically possible when you raise your input temperature significantly. Water-cooled reactors are really restricted how hot they can go because they're restricted by the basic properties of water. They can't get much above about 300 C. These reactors naturally operate at about anywhere from 600 to 700 C. So just from a straight thermodynamic perspective, they already have a lot more potential for high performance in them than a water-cooled reactor. And, you know, I'm from the West originally, and I always wondered when I was younger, why didn't we have nuclear reactors in the West? It's because we don't have big rivers in the West. With a reactor like this, you wouldn't build them nearly as big. You'd build them a lot more. You'd build them modular so you can build them in a factory and take them where you need to go. The footprint would be much smaller because you don't have the worry about need for an evacuation boundary and massive radiation release. Basically, there's nothing inside this reactor that wants to let go like a water reactor. You know, water reactors run under real high pressure. And if you depressurize it and you don't cool it, the fuel is going to melt down. I mean, that's the basic problem in a water-cooled reactor. This reactor doesn't even have that feature to begin with. It runs at atmospheric pressure. The fuel will pass, if you lose all power, the fuel will passively shut down. In other words, it drains out of the bottom into a drain tank and is passively cooled. So the fission products, the ones you're really worried about, are completely chemically occluded in the salt, particularly strontium and cesium. Very, very stable fluorides. So it's just got a completely different approach to just about everything than what we do today with a water-cooled reactor. And I think that's one of the problems when conventional nuclear folks look at it is they go, wow, this is just completely different in every way from what I'm doing now. You know, it's a brand new machine.
And without the graphite to moderate the neutrons, this thing basically shuts itself down. Right?
If you just put live fuel in a pool, it won't go. It can't achieve criticality because the neutrons aren't being moderated. That's another really neat thing about having separate moderator and fuel is if they're taken away from one another, the reaction is completely impossible.
Right, and so let's imagine for a minute we did have a release of the salt form. It's out in a pool. How radioactive is it?
Well, the salt's very radioactive, but it's going to freeze on contact with the kind of temperatures of which, you know, our world is made of. And it occludes those fission products in the salt itself. So, I mean, you wouldn't want to go near it or go pick it up, but there's nothing in it to disperse. You know, it's not in a form that wants to spread out in the environment. And so they're like a little hard rock.
Yep. So, and we could build these, if you said, in modular form, maybe instead of having to have these big, giant, centralized ones, because there's a lot of reasons for that, but the cooling is a big portion of that.
The cooling's a big deal. And the other thing about light water reactors is their economics get better the bigger you build them.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain things in that reactor that really favor a large scale. In our reactor design, there really aren't parameters that favor really being big or small. I mean, the scaling factor is just not nearly as intense. So if you want to say, I want to build it at 200 megawatts, you know, you can do that. And you can build a 200 megawatt light water reactor, but there's a lot of things that did not scale favorably by doing that.
Yeah, your overhead costs are going to kill you on that. All right. So this all sounds very interesting. And so I guess the final question is, why aren't we doing this?
The question I ask myself every night, Chris. Especially as I watch the news and I see all of these problems that are described, and I turn to my wife and I said, you know, all of these could potentially be solved through the application of lifter technology. I mean, it's just really amazing when you consider the scale of what's going on. Why aren't we doing this? Well, I'm doing it, and that's about all I can speak for is I'm trying to make it happen. I hope others will join me.
Well, I really appreciate you picking up the flag and running with it, because it certainly sounds exciting. It definitely, there's enough there that we owe it to ourselves, I believe, as a nation and possibly as a globe, to investigate it further, to either rule it in or rule it out conclusively. It sounds very intriguing at this point. So if people want to follow you and find out more and potentially even get in contact with you, how would they do that?
Go to our website, FlibEnergy, FLIBE-energy.com, and there's contact information on there. We also have the energyfromthorium.com site. That's, you know, it's not part of our company. It's something I started originally. Facebook and Twitter feeds off there. So there's a lot of different ways to follow what's going on if you're interested.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Kirk. It's been illuminating, and I really hope that we can help get the word out.
All right, my pleasure. Thank you, Chris.